McMahon, and we are broadcasting from the BBS studios in California, and I am coming through from Central Illinois, and I am so glad that you decided to join us on air today. You are listening to our very special music that's being done every week on the Peaceful Planet. Bob Murray is the talent behind our synthesized music from John Lennon, George Harrison, and other musical greats on the other side, and he is synthesizing this music as a service in love and light to the regular, to the community here. And then what you heard today were some samples of the lyrics that I've been writing with John Lennon, and we are very honored to bring these out on the show for you, and we couldn't be provided with better music, in my opinion, than to have John Lennon and George Harrison backing us up on the Peaceful Planet. But I want to let you know that we have the most wonderful guest today who has written a wonderful biography. Her name is Asha Praver, and she has written Swami Kriyananda. Did I pronounce that correctly, Asha?
Kriyananda.
Kriyananda, excuse me.
Uh-huh,
and
sure.
A little background for our listeners here. I'm going to read her bio in just a few minutes, but I want to just let you know that the spiritual legacy from which she is working is a great one. And I think many of you in the spiritual community have probably heard of the great master Paramhansa Yogananda, and I hope I pronounced that one correctly.
You did fine.
I'm not very versed in the Sanskrit or the Hindi or whatever, Indian language.
Yeah.
What happened with me, and I have to tell you my personal story here on air because I think a lot of our listeners will relate to this. A lot of people are interested in yoga, but actually it was Yogananda who was one of the great leaders that was told by his guru in India that his function would be to bring Kriya Yoga or Kriya Yoga to the West.
Kriya.
Kriya.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you,
mm-hmm.
Asha. And so he traveled with basically nothing and just a few dollars on him, came to Boston and spoke before, I think it was the Unitarian Society, way back when in the 20s or 30s sometime. And, oh, you know, people were just astounded at the master's teachings, and he developed quite a following. And this is really how yoga came to be so popular in America. So we are greatly honored because we're going to be reviewing a book on one of his disciples who has formed the Ananda community out in California, and now there are many Ananda communities throughout the world, and he's a direct disciple of Yogananda. And I am particularly honored to also read to our audience, as I usually do at the start of my shows, a channeled message. And it was actually last November where I was sitting in meditation, and the image of an Indian guru appeared to me. And normally I work with the Western Ascended Masters, and I was really stunned. I wasn't sure who it was. And he identified himself as the great Yogananda. So what an honor that was. And I have a very brief message to read to you from him that will kind of set the stage. And after I read the message, I'm also going to open up to a few readings if you are interested in a mini reading with me. You can also visit my website at dianaspeakstotheworld.com and sign up for a reading there. There's also an ad on BBS right now. But I'd like to just briefly share this with you. And this is how it unfolded when I had this very exciting moment in meditation some time ago from this message from Yogananda. So I'm saying here, I asked to speak to the master who spoke to me earlier this week. This is Paramhamsa Yogananda, the master teacher. I appear to you in my spirit form, and I say, now let's say, Namatse, you will be attracting new disciples from your town and surrounding towns, as many are now awakening to light. I was a yogi to many minds and opened the path of Dharma to initiates with the externalization of the spiritual hierarchy. I am honored to be one of many masters who come to your ascension group. I would ask that you make the autobiography of a yogi required reading for your group. I leave you in peace and infinite strength of your day and night. Namaste, Paramhamsa Yogananda. And I'm looking at a picture of him, and boy, he is just so filled with light. And so is your guru. So if you wouldn't mind saying his name again, Asha.
His name is Kriyananda, and he's called Swami Kriyananda, which is a title that means both teacher and monk, Swami Kriyananda.
Swami Kriyananda, beautiful. All right. Well, we are going to get to that in a few minutes, and I'm going to read your bio, too. But I'd like to open up, I'm opening to spirit, and I'd like to put our number out there for anyone that is wishing to have a mini reading. And if you want a reading, I would ask you to form your question ahead of time before you call so that it's easier for me to locate it from the records. And you know, center directly in so that we have more time to spend with our guest. But at the same time, I haven't done readings in a while, and I'm in the mood. So please feel free to call at 877-876-5227 in the U.S. or toll-free in Canada, 888-810-8322. And I am standing by to take a couple calls if you would like a free mini reading. Now, as we wait for the readings or any possible callers, I will begin to read Asha's bio, which is quite impressive. Now, she is the author of the book Swami Kriyananda, as we have known him, and this is about Asha. A Texas native, Asha Praver enrolled in Stanford University in 1965. For several years, she participated in anti-war protests and other counterculture events of the 60s. But her deepest interest has always been Eastern spirituality, and it wasn't long before this consuming passion caused her to drop out of college. In November 1969 came the day that changed her life. Asha attended a talk given at Stanford by Swami Kriyananda, a direct disciple of the great master of yoga, Paramhamsa Yogananda, author of the spiritual classic, author of Autobiography of a Yogi. Asha felt a deep connection with this great spiritual teacher, and a few years later she moved to the Ananda community that Swami had founded in the Sierra Nevada foothills. From that day to this, Asha's dual focus has been living her spiritual path of self-realization and sharing its teachings with others. Building on her close association with Swami Kriyananda, she served as his personal assistant and later as his secretary in the process of absorbing the Swami's wisdom. She also co-authored a cookbook and helped run Ananda Meditation Retreat, publications, and other businesses. Early on, Swami Kriyananda saw Asha's potential and groomed her for a life of leadership and public service. He sent her out to teach and lecture, and to date she has given thousands of classes, sermons, lectures in America, Europe, and Asia. In 1987, Asha moved to the San Francisco Peninsula with her husband, David, where they serve as co-leaders of the Ananda Temple in Palo Alto, across the street from Stanford University. The couple also co-founded the nearby Ananda community in Mountain View. Later, Asha helped found the Living Wisdom School in Palo Alto. Asha is an articulate speaker whose gift is to make the deeper teachings of yoga meaningful and applicable to modern life. She has helped thousands to a deeper understanding of themselves, and her ministry has included counseling hundreds of individuals and couples. She has a brilliant mind and an open and kindly manner. In 2007, she published Swami Kriyananda, As We Have Known Him. This work, which chronicles some of Asha's most inspiring personal memories of a modern sage, as well as those of many others, has received glowing reviews from professional and casual readers. So I'd like you to refer our listeners, Asha, to your website, too, if you could mention that.
In order to get the book, the website is doorofmyheart.com. doorofmyheart.com takes you right to the order page. The book is also available through amazon.com and most other sources. My personal website is Ananda, A-N-A-N-D-A, Palo Alto, the city of Palo Alto, .org, AnandaPaloAlto.org. Either of them will take you to me or to the book.
Oh, wonderful. I didn't know that about the book. And to our listeners listening, they can log on to BBS. My picture will be up there in about this program, and then you will see Asha's picture and a link directly to Ananda Palo Alto. But if you'd like to purchase the book, then you need to go to www.doorofmyheart.com. So
you can get the book. Ananda Palo Alto will lead you. The book is not hard to get. You can get it pretty much anywhere these days.
Well, it's quite a book you've got there, and so many things to talk about with your experience. But one of the first questions I have would be, and I'm going to follow some of your recommended questions, but not all. I wonder if you could explain the difference between Kriya Yoga and other forms of yoga like Hatha Yoga, which is what I do, just the physical exercises. And if you can go into some of the distinctions, I think our listeners would find this fascinating.
Certainly. The basic, what people call yoga now, they mostly mean physical yoga postures. And that's actually only one word. Yoga applies to a much bigger set of practices in science. People have taken one small part of it in America and think that's the whole thing. The whole thing is what they call Raja Yoga, which means royal yoga, the king's pathway. And it includes the practices of meditation, breathing exercises, actually philosophy, right behavior, and then also yoga postures. Yoga postures were actually created in order to create physical health and also to use the body to harmonize the mind so that you could eventually meditate. It was a means to an end. Mm-hmm. In America, the postures have become an end in themselves. They've also been taken in a sort of aerobic way that was not really the founder's intention, but it's a legitimate interpretation. Kriya Yoga specifically refers to a specific technique of meditation that is really ancient in origin and has been taught really for millennia under various names. Most recently, when Paramahansa Yogananda came to America in 1920, as you were referring to earlier, he took from this vast centuries of learning about how to affect consciousness, and he pulled out a few of the most fundamental methods and principles just to create for Americans an effective but a more or less streamlined system basically pruning the ancient tree a little bit and pulling off just the most viable branches. And then he called what he was teaching Kriya Yoga. Kriya actually means, the word actually just means action. So it was sort of like a specific action. It's a somewhat of an arbitrary name, but it's come now to mean, in many people's minds, the specific techniques that Yogananda taught, and then therefore his disciples taught, and it's what I also teach. The practice of Kriya per se is classical. He didn't invent it. He merely re-expressed something that's always been there. And Hatha Yoga, yoga postures, fits right into Kriya Yoga because the physical body is an important part of everyone's experience naturally, and it can either be an asset or a distraction to deeper meditation, and Hatha Yoga helps make the body an asset for everything else that we're trying to accomplish.
I see. Wow, what a wonderful explanation. You are so clear. I can really sense your teaching ability. That's amazing the way you describe that, Asha. Thank you. So, you know, I've been doing meditation for many years, but I don't think I had all my chakras aligned or my physical body in very good shape, so I took up the Hatha Yoga part of it, which, as you say, is perfectly valid, but I understand from reading as well in your book and in the autobiography of a yoga that Kriya does reach into the mystical realms of union with the Creator through the activation of the chakra systems. And I know that some of this is private knowledge, that not all of the public can handle it, but I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on how that works, like, you know, the cleansing of the blood and that kind of thing, if you can.
Oh, certainly. There's a great deal that can be said. And the only reason that portions of it are kept more esoteric, it's really not so much that that it's dangerous or unhealthy. It's more almost the opposite. It's that if you don't have sufficient background and enough habit of practice, spiritual practice, and you learn something like Kriya, basically you won't be able to practice it properly, and then the thought will rise in your mind that this doesn't work. So it's really simply not to dissipate the effect of it rather than anything else. The basic way that consciousness and spirit move in the body is completely scientific. It's just as scientific as all the medical research that people do now. Medicine is the science of how the physical body works. Physics is how energy flows in the universe. And when you sort of get into metaphysics, you're dealing with how energy flows in the universe, but then when you bring it specifically down to the consciousness of the individual, how human consciousness works, how infinite energy ends up manifesting as one personality, one ego, identified with one body, and then how that ego and that individual, which is you and me, can essentially trace that pathway back to its source. And it's not random or confused. It's extremely specific. So Kriya Yoga, the whole science that people talk about, the chakras, which are specific energy centers in the body, the kundalini, which is the energy itself that flows in the body, all of these things are objective realities, but they can't be perceived with the senses. You have to develop a more intuitive form of perception. But once you're into that intuitive form, it's very systematic. So what Kriya Yoga is, it utilizes basic elements like breath and energy and concentration to work directly with kundalini energy through the chakras in order to raise, I think expand is the word, to expand our awareness from what we automatically see with the senses to the energy fields that are behind what the senses see. It's interesting because so many scientists, but from a completely different angle, are actually coming to exactly the same conclusions, that the world is not what it seems, that there's another reality going on. And what meditation is, and what Kriya Yoga specifically is training our consciousness to perceive more than the senses can perceive. There's always been this medical mystery, so to speak, which is that so much, there seems to be so much more of the brain and human nervous system than the average person uses. And the answer to that is that we can make ourselves essentially superhuman, or more accurately, fully human, that all of that brain and nervous system can be awakened and developed, and Kriya is fundamentally techniques for doing that, that start at a basic level and have literally no end, just depending how conscientiously and energetically we apply ourselves.
Wow. So I assume then that you personally have been trained by your master, and that you have engaged in a lifelong application of the methods of the yoga that you've been trained in, which would, I assume, include the hatha yoga, but do you also do specific meditations and postures and that sort of thing?
Yes, my practice, hatha yoga is not the center of my practice. My practice is meditation itself, which is Kriya Yoga. And also Yogananda created something he calls energization exercises, which are, it's not exactly hatha yoga. It's somewhere between hatha yoga and meditation. It uses the body, but in a more subtle manner. And so that's a supportive exercise also for meditation. And yes, I was initiated in 1971 by Swami Kriyananda, and it's been a daily practice all these years since. It becomes a deeply ingrained habit that one feels uneasy if you're not practicing, just like you get hungry for lunch, you get hungry for meditation.
Well, sure, and I do meditation too, and I'm sure that I could benefit from learning more with the Kriya Yoga. It's so different. Kriya Yoga, excuse me. It's so different in technique and so on, and it does something for your chakras, etc. But I do feel the connection on the astral planes to many of the masters, and it's it was really an honor when I heard from Yogananda, and I wasn't even sure which yogi I was speaking to at the time. And then I had to go and look him up, and then I found the autobiography of a yogi and read it for the first time. But we're not talking about that book today, but it is a wonderful primer for your book. So we're talking about your book and the work that your master has been working on all his life, and some of the daily experiences and wisdom that you drew from him and so on. So how did you know that he was your spiritual mentor?
Well, I was a seeker, like many people, really from childhood. I always had a very strong sense that there was, I couldn't have articulated, but I sensed that the world around me was not everything. And so I was very dissatisfied, and I first expressed that as you were reading by trying to affect the world around me. But I was introduced when I was just 18 to serious spiritual and metaphysical writing, and it intuitively made sense to me that we were working with other dimensions that were influencing this one. And quite frankly, when Swami, but my dilemma that I felt was that I couldn't think how to make it practical. It was extremely mind expanding, but my daily life just seemed to go on in the same grind, and I couldn't figure out how to put the two of them together. And then Swami Kriyananda came to Stanford to speak, and I went to his lecture, and my first recognition was entirely intuitive. I was 22 at the time, he was 43. And he walked in, and I just had this feeling about him that he had integrated these extremely expansive ideas with a very practical, everyday way of life. And it was the personification of what I had wanted my whole life. And I was immediately magnetized to it, really in a matter of almost of seconds. I had the feeling that this man could teach me what I wanted to know. I'm not a credulous person. But I'm also willing to follow an intuitive thought when it comes. So I immediately, essentially, began to explore whether or not that possibility was true. Now, all these years later, it certainly has proved to be true.
I should say so. So you were in the right place at the right time with an aha moment, and your life path was made clear to you. What an amazing event. See, I don't think that my spiritual path whatever have unfolded in quite the same way, because we all experience our spirituality in such different ways. And of course, I was raised in the Western traditions, but of course, when I was growing up in the 70s, I was part of the anti-war movement, and I was into all of the same things you were, only, you know, maybe a few years later. And I think that was a wonderful mind-opening time to be alive, to say the least.
I definitely feel that, yes.
And I think that everyone then that we're talking about, maybe the 60s and 70s, the flower children, the hippies, people that were awakening at that time were in truth awakening. I think some people took wrong turns with drugs and other substances,
right.
And they took wrong turns with, you know, some of the other things that they did that made their lives extremely confused and then got on the wrong paths. And I don't know why there were so many negative paths available then, but that is the conundrum of the negative ego, that we all have to resist those temptations, you know. But I myself was, you know, at that point good friends with a lady who was doing yoga, and I took a few classes, but at that time it didn't resonate with me, and unfortunately it just didn't, but now it completely resonates. So it's possible that, you know, we all have different levels of spiritual development, and we're only ready for that when the time arrives, and luckily you were in the right place at the right time, as they say. You know,
in all these years, the one thing I have observed is that there's a personal path, and that's one of the fundamentals that Yogananda and Kriyananda and Ananda, all of us since then, have really tried to restore. This is, we call it self-realization. It's really about your own enfoldment. There are, of course, universal principles, and there are recognizable guideposts that everyone passes, but individual karma just dictates that you follow the path that unties your own personal knots, and you can't just universalize it. You can't institutionalize it. It's not the same for everyone. You have to be very loyal to your own way.
What I love about the Eastern paths, though, is the physical discipline involved. That helps me, but I'm not a very physical person. I'm mostly mental, so having that physical outlet for me has been a very good learning experience, I have to say. But the other thing, too, is that I think I've always respected the Eastern tradition because they respect the intuitive and because I'm a gifted intuitive myself. It flows naturally that spiritually advancing and utilizing your intuitive gifts or your hunches and also your intuitions and your whole body, mind, spirit, as we understand ourselves to be, is natural. It seems like we cannot advance if we're just on a physical path. We cannot advance if we're just on a mental path. And sometimes spiritual seekers get on a spiritual path, but they find roadblocks because they're not incorporating the mental and the physical into the whole picture. And that's what I really like about the Eastern tradition, because it gives us all that. And that's really what was missing, I think, all along from a lot of these Western religions, don't you think?
Oh, yes, I completely agree. And in Yogananda's teachings, and really I have to say especially in the way Kriyananda has interpreted them, it's just simply a fully integrated path. And in fact, the particular work that Kriyananda was given by his guru to do was to start communities. And I've helped start two of the eight that Ananda has now, where it's a full lifestyle, where it's not just for monks and nuns, but for families with children. And we've had to, you know, create and run businesses and schools for the children, and we've raised two generations of children at our original community, which is now 40
really?
Years old.
Wow,
and so,
I didn't know that.
So we've been forced to think not just in a narrow channel, but it's like, okay, how does all of life integrate with these spiritual ideals? And I think it's the wave of the future for spirituality. People are really wanting to understand, you might say, how to spiritualize everything that they're doing, their marriages, the way they make money, the art. It's all trying to bring spirit and the world, so to speak, matter, energy, and consciousness all into one flow. And that's been Ananda's specialty. And for me personally, the personification of that has been, and still is, because Kriyananda is still living, he's always personified for me this extremely expanded and practical way of living. And
wow.
In my association with him, which has been quite close now for almost four decades, I've just seen him in all circumstances of life, you know, in relationships, in friendships, in money. We had lawsuits, we've founded organizations, we've traveled through the world, and just doing everything that everybody's asked to do, but do it with a spirit-first attitude. How does it really manifest? And through all those years, I took a lot of notes, and what I've written up is just incident after incident. It's all just vignettes. I made no attempt to really philosophize or even to write a conventional biography. It's just moments in time in which the clarity of truth was being manifested in specific ways. So sometimes when people write about someone who's been very important to them, it's a great deal just about how wonderful the person is. And, of course, that is how I feel. But my intention in writing this book was simply to give people the same experiences that I had and others and just let them draw their own conclusions. Here are the facts. Here are the teachings. Here are the observations and experiences in an engaging manner, and then let others decide if it's meaningful to them as it has been to me.
Right, and I think that the anecdotal stories that you share are truly amazing, and they do offer the practical insight and wisdom that he is manifesting in the world today, and obviously he's adding a great deal of light to the world with his teaching. I was so surprised when I got to the end of the book and discovered that, hey, he's gone back to India. That really threw me. That is amazing.
Yeah. Well, it was amazing to all of us. He's American, even though the tradition is India. He spent years in India, but it was way back in the late 50s. And then at the age of, 78, he just literally felt the inner impulse from God that he needed to, before he died, he needed to carry the Indian teachings back to India because what Yogananda brought to America was a distillation. It's not Hinduism at all. It's what Yogananda called a new expression. And so he took the essence of the teachings of self-realization, which are not a religion per se, there are practices, and he simplified it. And so, you know, India is westernizing at this point. So to have a group of Americans and Western Europeans come back to India to teach the teachings of India to the Indians has been actually just a marvelous experience for everyone. Because many young Indians were turning their back on that tradition because it was too heavy with ritual and incomprehensible dogmas, just like Western religions have become.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Kriyananda brought
there's a lot of problems in the world religions. I can say that. But the Hindu religion itself, and I'm just speaking as an observer, not an expert like yourself, but it seems like it is a much more holistic religion or practice of life, and they seem to incorporate all facets of, I mean, they have so many versions of yoga, for instance, and so many temples and so many devas, and it's just endless. And they don't seem to be as focused on one particular way like we are in the West, you know.
Well, the West decided, I mean, the Catholic Church decided, and the Protestants have modeled themselves on it, that people weren't capable of protecting themselves from false teachings. And so everything had to be institutionalized and figured out, and the right and the wrong of, well, the teachings of Jesus had to be defined. This is truth and this is heresy. The Indian tradition has always been guru-disciple. The guru has many disciples, and some of them are wiser than others.
Mm-hmm.
And the wise disciples will create an enduring tradition, and the less wise disciples will influence things for a while, and then whatever they teach that's false will simply die away.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been no need to supervise it.
Yeah.
As a result, you have fallacy. But over time, truth itself is the criteria rather than dogma or institution.
That's brilliantly put. Boy, I love the way you teach. You are marvelous. You are really
well. I learned
marvelous.
It all from Swami Kriyananda. I take no personal credit.
Oh,
I'm repeating to you what I learned from him.
Because you're the one doing the talking and the thinking right now. So you've synthesized his teaching. But it is a great teaching. And I agree with you on the Western points because it's filled with rules and regulations, but I've done a series on the Mary Magdalene mysteries, and I've got an awful lot of information now from the Master Jesus, whom I work very close with. And I know that Yogananda was very, very into Jesus, and Jesus appeared to him as well. So, yes. You know, he has incorporated Christianity into some of the self-realization teachings, and I also resonate with that, because so many Westerners do resonate with Jesus, but probably
he's
problems with the dogma, you know.
Yogananda made a distinction. He said one religion is churchianity, and the other, the true religion of Jesus, is Christianity.
Yeah,
and that
just
sort of makes it very clear.
Yeah. Yeah. So can you share with us, now I want to make one other comment that responds to what you were saying about the relationship of guru and disciple. And I read it in the Conversations with God books. I don't remember the exact quote from Neil Donald Walsh, but this is a channeled book from his higher source. And he said, only a great teacher produces more great teachers. You know, it's not the number of disciples that you get, it's the great teachers that you get. So on that point, I'm thinking of your teacher, you know.
Well, I would definitely say that the definition of a true guru is one who is capable of raising others to his own level of complete realization. And there are many people who can definitely benefit others. In India, they call it a sat guru, which is a full guru. Mm-hmm. And the sat guru was Yogananda, and he was a fully realized master, and he was capable of transmitting that to others. And yes, one great disciple, Swami Kriyananda as an example, one great disciple, and he's reached millions. He's written, his books are in 29 languages. They're distributed in 100 countries. He's written like 80 books at this point, some of them, you know, bigger and smaller works, and they're just, the titles are all over the planet in all the languages. The example of communities that Kriyananda was able to establish, it's a social pattern that will become more popular in the future. In a sense, Yogananda put the blueprint. Kriyananda really brought those plans, the beginning of bringing them into fruition, and I think over time, it's still a little bit ahead of its time. But, when you look back, the whole of Christianity was created by Paul.
Single-handedly.
And if there had been no Paul.
Unfortunately, that was where a lot of the dogma crept in. Really, well, his stance on women, et cetera, yeah.
Well, there was a fight between the Catholic Church and the more mystical Gnostics, and the Church won.
Right. Well, that's exactly what Mary Magdalene told me, and I have a Holy Grail series that you can actually get from my website, and it's a compilation of wonderful interviews and experts, and you're exactly right. The Gnostic tradition is the mystical Christian tradition, which was initiated by some of the disciples along with Mary Magdalene. And Mary Magdalene had her own gospel, et cetera. And what she did is she connected with, she connected with the higher energies, and she was able to channel and all of that. You know, so that is really what Jesus was teaching when he said the kingdom of God is within you. He was talking about being able to contact Source, whether, you know, in your tradition, Source through the initiation of yoga and the science of yoga and the raising of the kundalini, or, you know, the intuitive abilities that I have. All of it is, and now I think we see clearly that all of this is moving us as a humanity into a greater spirituality of oneness, is what I call it, and moving us away from the separation consciousness that is the unfortunate result of all the religious wars and all the religions thinking that they have it one over the other, you know.
Right.
So, So let's get on to what is the most important lesson that you think you've learned from your teacher?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the first lesson is humility.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to understand that we are just small instruments of a greater power, and that's an inner belief. And then the way that expresses is to be very respectful of other human beings. But I would also say that with that humility comes an ability to also be a very powerful expressor of that divine flow. Because mm-hmm. if there is sufficient humility, then there's a clarity of understanding and an ability to be intuitively guided.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, and then I was going to say the other force of that, I would say, would be love. That love not in just a sentimental sense, but in what I have seen in all my years with Swami Kriyananda, he has an extraordinary regard for individuals and a complete willingness to help each person move forward from wherever they're standing. When I look back at the way he's worked with me, which of course I know best, he's always been able to find a positive direction for me to go. No matter how stupidly I might be behaving or brilliantly I might be behaving, he was always able to just see right where the reality of where I'm standing and what would be a forward step for me. And everyone that I know who's been close to him, everyone considers him their best friend. And he manages by his own perception of us. And this is not a... Well, I'll give an example that's in the book. I was 22 when I first met him. And by the time I was 24, I was working very closely with him. He was in his 40s by then and really very well established inside himself as a disciple and spiritually. I was always very strong-minded and had what I can only call an unwarranted faith in my own opinions. And yet, he always treated me, always, with tremendous respect. He always listened attentively to what I said. And in fact, I find out later, you know, he often went along with me merely to be respectful of me, even when he knew for a fact that what I was thinking was not going to lead us where we were trying to go. And as years passed and I gradually took on a position of leadership myself and became older, I began to work with people who are like I am, 20-some years younger and with 20 years less experience in what we're all trying to do. And of course, the temptation would cross my mind sometimes to pull the card of age and experience over the card of youth. But because Swami Kriyananda never, ever, in all the years that I've known him, has ever referred to the difference in our age and experience, he's always, as he put it, let truth speak for itself. And if he couldn't persuade me of the truth of something, he wouldn't just use authority, ever. Even contrary to people's idea of what a spiritual teacher is like, he's never used authority. It's reason, it's truth, it's a unified sense of we're all in this together. So I, in appreciation, when I began to experience this, I went to him and I said, Swamiji, I want to thank you for never making me feel young and inexperienced, even though I really was, for always respecting my potential rather than responding to my reality. Well, the response I got from him, again, expanded my understanding. Of course, he was gracious about my compliment, but there was this slight puzzlement in his expression, which I've learned to respect, and I sort of waited for the rest of it. And I said, you never once referred to my age. His response was, I never noticed. He said, age is only a factor of the body. He said, I never notice how old people are. He said, the soul is ageless. And then, of course, I realized that what for me was, you know, like the disciplined expression of the right attitude was for him the simple perception of reality. He said, even children, he said, naturally, children's reality is slightly different, so intuitively you have to respond appropriately, but it's not an aged-based response. It's just that that's their consciousness, so I'll relate to it response. In another context, a group of us were having dinner together in a couple in our community was separating. They'd had a very difficult relationship as it was, and it wasn't really a surprise that they'd separated. And we were talking about it, just close friends with Swami Kriyananda at the dinner table. And I made a reference to an experience I'd had where I'd gone shopping with the wife, and we were buying a present for her husband, as it were, and I pulled out this shirt, and I said, oh, this would be wonderful for him. The color exactly matches his eyes. And the wife said to me, oh, does it? What color are his eyes? And so at the dinner table, I said, well, no wonder they got divorced. She doesn't even know what color his eyes are. Mm-hmm. Well, once again, everybody, of course, agreed with me. Well, once again, Swami Kriyananda you know, acquiesced, but he had this slightly puzzled look on his face. He said again, he said, I have no idea what color people's eyes are. He said, I don't look at their eyes. He said, I look through their eyes to the consciousness behind it. And there was a woman sitting next to, there was a woman sitting next to him who'd been his close associate on an almost daily basis for 25 years. He turned and looked at her, and he said, I don't even know the color of Seva's eyes here. And then he looked and he said, and sort of peered at her, and he said, oh, they're brown. I mean, she has these huge brown eyes that were her defining feature. He said, oh, they're brown. He couldn't have told us. And he just sort of, but otherwise, when you're working and living with him, he's not at all ungrounded. He's perfectly practical. He moves through the world very efficiently and effectively. But you can, you realize that he's one dimension up.
Yeah, and it's coming from another place where he's really concentrating on what I would call as a psychic. He's picking up on the vibration of the person, and he's
picking up on the vibration.
The person, and he's maybe not picking up on the details as much, which can happen when people are tuned in a little differently, or a higher level of tuning in, as you would say. Yeah, so that's amazing. I mean, it's amazing to me that you had this moment when you were 22, and it shaped your world. But I also think that we're always given opportunities to make a choice for a spiritual path, whatever that choice is. And sometimes they do recycle themselves, you know? So maybe we passed it up one time. Like, you know, I did take yoga lessons with my good friend, Rhonda, in college, and it was just so happened that she lived right next door to me, and she also introduced me to vegetarianism, which was great. And then in my 20s, I became a vegetarian, and I did study yoga with her for a time. And then I kind of got to a point where I just didn't make progress, so I let it go. And then I gave up vegetarianism for a long time, and now I'm back to vegetarianism and yoga. So, you know, it flows back and forth, and sometimes, you know, our lessons recirculate for us to choose again, don't they?
I think it's like the tide coming in. You know, sometimes the wave goes way up the beach, and then it takes a while before it gets up that far up the beach again. The good news is, I mean, we have as much time as we want. The question of time is just a question of how long and in what ways we want to live. But as soon as our intention is focused in a certain way, every supportive field in the universe will come to our aid. This whole concept that we could be lost forever is just absolute folly. We always have hope. And again, from Swami Kriyananda, that's what I've seen. He just, no matter what, I remember once a woman was doing something that she shouldn't have done. And he had counseled her in another direction, but she just wasn't able to do it. So she just honestly and directly said to him, sir, I can't follow the advice you're giving me. In just a heartbeat, he didn't even pause. He said, well, so much for theory. Let's deal with reality. And he said, okay, given this is, you know, a too strong an inclination in you, then let's start moving it in a positive direction. And then he said, well, let's do what you're going to do in the most uplifted way possible, if that's really where your energy is going to go anyway.
He's amazing. What a guy. Now, you must really miss him because he's in India now, and you're running your own community in Palo Alto, correct? Tell us about your community and how you work and how initiates can come into the community and what you're offering, and then how you stay in touch with the Swami, if you do. And I know you've probably learned an awful lot from him, and you miss him, but, you know, how that's all worked out for you.
About 20 years ago, half of my spiritual life, I worked very closely with him for a while, and then he said to me quite simply, and he said it was true, he said, you know, it's a sacrifice for both of us, and he said, but it's not fair to you to just have you be my assistant. He said, it's not what you were born to do. He said, you have to learn to stand on your own feet. And it was very sad is the only word I can use, except, of course, it was correct, so I accepted it graciously. But I haven't lived on the same continent for a decade, and I haven't lived in the same community for 20 years. Of course, this world being what it is, between telephone, email, and airplane flights, you can just get anywhere within a matter of hours. So I'm in touch with him, you know, every few days, and have been for all these years, and spend weeks or months at a time. In fact, he's coming now to spend most of the summer, at the 2008, from June through September, he'll be in America this year. India's awfully hot. So,
yeah.
But what you were saying about our community is, the first Ananda community, it was and is rural. It's near Grass Valley, and it's even outside of Grass Valley, which is a very rural area. It's not wilderness, but it's going toward Lake Tahoe. It's in that part of California. And it's actually it's 1,000 acres now, and it's completely self-sustaining village, self-contained village, where people live, have their jobs, we have schools for the children, we have many little enterprises, we have a fabulous year-round retreat there called the Expanding Light. If people are not in California, if you're living elsewhere, the first place to meet Ananda is to go up to the Expanding Light, to Ananda Village. If you just look up Ananda on the internet, it'll lead you to all of these.
I've got to try that sometime. That sounds wonderful.
It's a glorious place. I can't say enough. For 40 years, that land has been inhabited by people who meditate and practice yoga. And it's just created an atmosphere that I've traveled a lot. It's unique in the world that one group of people have so systematically and conscientiously done spiritual practice in one place for so long. Plus, it's a whole village. So you have all these families. And Swami Kriyananda himself lived there until 1998. Then he moved to Europe, and then from Europe he moved to India. And he still has a home there. So basically, he really lives on three continents now. He just divides his time. His first years in India, he didn't leave. But now after 5 years, he travels more. But the problem with that community, even though I think it's heaven on earth, is that it's rural. It's people have to, you know, give up their circumstances to come live there. It's not it's not the average lifestyle. So in 1987, Swami asked me, and by then I was married to a wonderful man named David, and he asked us to move down to Palo Alto, which it happened to be where I came from, which is just south of San Francisco in California, and see what we could do to establish the same basic lifestyle, but in a setting that was more familiar to people. And also, if the goal is to share what you know, you have to go where the people are. You can't expect them to travel just to travel to you. Retreats
and
obviously
have... interesting, too, Asha, that it seems like it's near Stanford where you first began.
Right. Life
comes back in a big circle, doesn't it?
I seem to have a karma with the place, that's for sure.
Don't you, though? I'd love to see all that, and I'd love to speak with you again. We are pretty much out of time for our show.
Okay.
And I want to ask you to please give out your websites again. And if you have any particular last parting word on you know, your book or anything, The Master, please share that with us.
Okay, well, the websites, the word you want is Ananda, A-N-A-N-D-A. If you Google that, Ananda, it will lead you to Ananda, the central Ananda, and then Ananda Palo Alto, P-A-L-O-A-L-T-O. Ananda Palo Alto is where I and my husband live. If you want to order my book directly, doorofmyheart.com. But if you just start with Ananda, you'll find all of it. And if I had parting words, I would say to people, open your hearts, open your mind, open your soul, and everything you're looking for will come to you.
Wonderful. What a wonderful blessing you have been to be on our Peaceful Planet show, and what an honor it is to speak with you, and you are so well-spoken and well-educated. It was really a pleasure speaking with you.
Marcia, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I've enjoyed it, too.
You're more than welcome, and let's stay in touch through email, etc. And I want to close out with a special song titled Eternal Opus, if Don could play that as we exit, and invite my listeners to my website at dianaspeakstotheworld.com. Thank you all for listening, and join us again next week.